Hi, and welcome to Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host today, Dr. Amber Luong from the McGovern Medical School of the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. Today, I've invited Dr. Zara Patel, a rhinologist and professor at Stanford Medical School, to discuss her manuscript entitled Long-Term Outcomes of PRP Injections for Post-Viral Olfactory Loss, a Prospective Cohort Study, from this April's edition of IFAR. So welcome, Zara, and thanks for your time today to discuss the results of this long-term prospective trial. I hope you're having a good day, not too crazy.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure to be here and talk about this.
Yeah, so I think this is a follow-up on potentially a study that we may have featured earlier, but I know that you've had a long-term interest in olfaction and specifically post-viral olfactory loss. So what was the current treatment outlook for post-viral olfactory loss when you kind of started the study, just to kind of give us some background?
So, you know, before any interest that I had in PRP, the main things that we know or knew could help people with post-viral olfactory loss were a few things. We knew that something called olfactory training, which hopefully many of our listeners are already familiar with, could be helpful. That's really just a structured smelling protocol that you do, you know, at least twice a day for many months. And it's really just exercising the system of smell. Like I tell my patients, if they had a stroke and they couldn't use their arm, they would go to physical therapy and work that arm to get the function back and create those synaptic processes back. And that's really what olfactory training is for, loss of smell from really any etiology. So that is something that we were doing. But unfortunately, that really only helps, you know, depending on the study you read, 30 to 50% of patients. So really a huge gap still in really being able to help everybody. In addition to that, I had run a randomized controlled trial some years back adding high volume steroid irrigations to olfactory training for this patient population. And that seemed to increase the efficacy. So a significantly greater proportion of patients had improvement in their smell when they added that, even when they didn't have any sign of sinus or nasal inflammation, probably because this is inflammation at a microscopic level that we're talking about. And so those were things that I offered my patients. Other things, you know, were either not well studied or extrapolations from other types of study. Like I would give my patients high dose of omega-3 because I had studied that in an endoscopic skull-based surgery patient population who were having difficulty with smell, and it was helpful for them. So I would tell my post-viral patients about that. But other things, you know, common things used in Europe, like alpha-lipoic acid or topical vitamin A, either don't have good evidence or they're not available. Like topical vitamin A that's not toxic to the cilia is not really available here in the U.S. And so there's different reasons why, you know, that was really the mainstay. The olfactory training, the budesonide irrigations, and the omega-3 are the things that I had offered patients prior to PRP.
Yeah. Well, when I was looking at the medical field's experience with PRP, it looked like it was primarily used for like orthopedic injuries. And they mentioned, you know, for musculoskeletal injuries. I didn't really see much in terms of like neurologic injuries. So what made you think about its use for, you know, these types of neurologic injuries?
So it is most commonly used in orthopedics and the longest used in orthopedics, but it has been used in many other medical fields, neurology being one of them. And I became most interested when I read a neurology study. I do follow the neurology literature because olfaction really is a neurologic issue, and I take inspiration from that literature a lot. And I saw this study that was actually a carpal tunnel study where they separated the patients into three groups. They had either a medical physical therapy type of arm, they did a carpal tunnel release surgery arm, and then another arm with an injection of PRP into the carpal tunnel. And not only did both the surgery arm and the PRP arm do significantly better than the medical and physical therapy arm, but they were not significantly different from each other. So I thought that was really interesting and thought, okay, well, this is a well-done study. I think there is something to be explored here. And that's what caused me to run my first pilot study looking at PRP for olfaction. And that was before the pandemic ever hit. That was just to see, you know, is this feasible? Can I numb people up enough in the nose and reach the olfactory cleft and get this whole process done? And is it safe? I didn't want to make anyone worse, have a decrease or cause some bad distortion of smell by doing this. And so that was a very small number of patients. And I did prove those, you know, safety and feasibility things in that study. Mm-hmm. And I saw an interesting enough improvement in their threshold that I thought, okay, this is worthwhile actually running a randomized controlled trial. And then I ran the randomized controlled trial after the pandemic hit. And so that's why it was specifically a COVID-19 patient population that we studied. Now, this latest study, the long-term outcomes is kind of a follow-up to that initial randomized controlled trial study that looked at whether or not the success of the randomized controlled trial, whether we were going to be able to see sustained benefit or whether that initial improvement just went back down to their initial baseline.
So that's perfect segue. Can you just kind of highlight what you found in that earlier study in terms of like what outcomes? And then we'll go into the specific cohort for this long-term study, because I think you wanted to get a certain power. So it was a little bit of a mixture. So I'd love to understand a little bit of the details of that cohort.
Yeah. So the initial randomized controlled trial, we controlled really well. So we had enrolled a total of 35 patients and 26 of them completed the study. We randomized these patients to PRP injection arm versus a sham saline injection arm. And the protocol that we used, again, was just taken from other medical fields. So it was three injections separated by 2 weeks each. And so we had used the sniff and sticks test in that initial randomized controlled trial that gives the most granular data of threshold, identification, discrimination, different facets of smell. And what we found in that initial study was that after three injections, the arms separated, and there was a statistically significant difference in that what's called the TDI score, that sniff and sticks score of smell. Now, what we also measured in that randomized controlled trial was just a VAS, a visual analog scale of how people felt like they were doing as far as their smell goes on a scale of, you know, 0 to 10. And although there was an improvement in the VAS also, there was an improvement in the control arm, and that difference did not end up being statistically significant in that measurement that was just, you know, directly after the three injections were done. So at that time, we said, okay, this definitely improves things based on this quantitative measure. And it also improves things on the visual analog scale, but not enough different than this spontaneous improvement, because there is some amount of spontaneous improvement that occurs in post-viral patients over time. So then when we, you know, followed up this group a year later, so what you were talking about before was that, so just to kind of make it clear for everybody, the PRP arm, if you think about like how much better did they do, they had a greater than 12 times odds of improvement versus the sham saline injection arm.
Wow.
So then, yeah, so pretty good difference. And then when we decided, okay, let's look now a year later after these injections, what is it going to show? So we weren't able to get all of the randomized control patients back. Some were lost to follow-up. Some were just not interested in doing, you know, enrolling in another study. And so of that initial cohort of patients that were in the randomized controlled trial, we were able to get, you know, 16 patients from that initial randomized controlled trial group. So 10 of them were in the PRP group, and 6 of them had been in that placebo sham saline injection group. And so to supplement the numbers so that we really had a well-powered study, we then just drew from patients from my clinic, because by then, after the initial trial was successful, I opened this up as a treatment option for all of my smell loss patients. And so we did still restrict it to post-viral patients. And so we added 6 PRP patients and 10 non-PRP patients from just my clinic, who, again, had already been doing all the other stuff like olfactory training and budesonide irrigations, all these things. And so when we looked at this a year out from their injections, we not only saw that the improvements were sustained, but the trajectory of that improvement actually continued to go up compared to the non-PRP group. And so higher number of patients. So the difference became, you know, greater than 87% of patients in that PRP group versus just 31% of patients had a minimal clinically important difference on the upsit. This time we used just the upsit as our test, right, because it was something we could send out to patients instead of having them all come back from all over the country and world. And not only that, but we now, a year out on that visual analog scale, that was also a statistically significant difference. It had sort of, you know, the trajectory of the arm had increased enough that when you looked at the spontaneous improvement arm, although there was that slow, steady climb, it was nowhere near the trajectory of the PRP arm. And so that basically came to an odds ratio of improvement of 15 now. So greater than 15 times odds of improving a year out from the PRP injections versus not getting that.
Oh, that's great. So let's go into some of the details. So for those of us who might be interested in trying it, so let's talk about the technique. I guess, what's the needle that you use? Where do you inject? How do you pre-treat patients? And do you give them any more than three injections? Do they start having, I know that you followed up for a year, but let's say they start saying that something's decreased. Do you give them more than three injections? So can you go over kind of the nitty gritty details?
So I will go over the details now, but just to give people a resource, I have just built a website, the Stanford Initiative to Cure Smell and Taste Loss. And so there's a video that's posted there where I go into great detail about all this. So anyone that wants to look at that video, you can. It's on YouTube and you can find it. But so basically, we get a kit. The company that we have used is called M-Site, but I'm sure there's lots of different companies. There's different types of PRP kits. So depending on what the, you know, exact percentage of platelets versus the rest of the blood that you want, you can choose different types of kits. And so we have put in the paper the exact kit that we use. And so I suggest people use that one since that's the one that has shown benefit. And you draw about 30 milliliters of blood from the patient. The nurse comes in and draws it. While the nurse is taking the blood to the centrifuge and spinning it down via this very specific multi-step protocol, we're numbing the patient. So you give the patient a global spray of whatever you usually numb them with to scope them in your clinic, and then another directed spray right up into the olfactory cleft. I used to soak cotton pledgets in that same numbing medicine and place that in the olfactory cleft, but I actually no longer do that. I've realized that the pressure of the pledget placement is worse than the injection itself. And so I just spray people, and the vast majority of everyone it deals with that quite well. So what you get from that 30 mils of blood is about 2 to 3 cc's. So I have my nurses separate that into 2 3 cc syringes. So it's about 1.5 cc's in each syringe. I use a 25 gauge, 1.5 inch needle. I bend the tip of the needle slightly so that I can get around the septal body or any septal deviation that we need to get around to reach the olfactory cleft. And then, you know, you basically just give them one last spray before you go in to do the injection. And then you go up into the olfactory cleft. The area that I aim for is basically just the septum mucosa that's directly opposite from the superior meatus. So that transition between the middle and the superior turbinate, that's really where your olfactory epithelium begins on the septum. And so that's where I'm injecting. Now, I used to do 2 injection sites, and in the randomized control trial, I standardized that. So it was very standard for everyone, one in that location and then one a little bit more posterior inferior in the cleft. But now I've realized you can actually see when you inject where the PRP is spreading. And in some patients, it spreads really nicely and kind of covers that entire submucosal area of the entire olfactory epithelium. In those patients, I just stay in that one injection point and keep injecting. In other patients, you'll feel more resistance and it won't be able to spread through that whole area. So for those patients, I do again choose another secondary, more posterior inferior kind of location as the, you know, skull base slopes down, and inject again right there. And you basically just give it all to them, whatever you have gotten, whether it's 1 cc's or 1.5 cc's per side, I just inject all of that in there for them now that I'm not on a steady protocol. So that is basically it. And then just so people know kind of what to counsel their patients about, very common for patients to feel pressure right in the middle of their head when you're doing it. And then some patients will feel pressure in other areas of their head randomly, and probably because all those nerves are connected in there. And so regardless, that sensation for almost everybody rapidly goes away as soon as the injection is complete.
And there hasn't been any like other side effects, either long-term, maybe later on in the day, that people have reported or
Rarely, some patients will say, oh, I still had like a pressure or like a headache that evening, or maybe even the next day. Pretty rare, but some patients have said that. And then even more rare, some patients will say, oh, I had a little nosebleed after I walked out of your clinic or the next day, but they just held pressure and it stopped. So that is really the extent of it.
And are there any patients that you would say are not good candidates for this, or that you should avoid because of concerns for other issues?
Yeah. So the only patients that I've said I won't do it are ones I can't. If their septal deviation is so slammed over, like touching their lateral nasal wall, and you just can't even get to see the olfactory epithelium or cleft, then, you know, I have had a few quite desperate patients. All of these patients are quite desperate for something that will help them, who have actually decided to undergo a septoplasty just so that I could reach the olfactory cleft for the PRP. Now, I've obviously counseled quite rigorously that the septoplasty is not going to bring their smell back. They should only get a septoplasty if they're sensing nasal obstruction. And, you know, those few patients that we've done that for, they will say, yeah, you know, I do feel nasal obstruction. It maybe wasn't something bothersome enough that I would have had surgery before, but if it helps me with my nasal obstruction and it allows you to reach the cleft, then maybe it's worth it. So that's a few patients. But really, you know, not being able to reach the cleft is the one, like, really primary contraindication.
Yeah.
And I guess one other thing that I've come across just a couple times are people with underlying leukemias or blood disorders. Right. And so for those patients, I have not done it simply because I really don't know how that would affect it. I don't know if that would even be effective at all, or if it could potentially transfer their leukemia to a different part of their body. You know, I don't know what that would do. And so I've just stayed away from people with blood cancers, blood disorders, but that's basically it.
Got it. So when you started telling me about the technical part, you did emphasize that, you know, the kit can be important. And I read your discussion about, you know, there are a lot of kind of mixed efficacy, I guess. And part of that may be, as you said, the platelet-rich plasma can vary in terms of growth factors, can vary. Some people are talking about lymphocyte-rich, or, you know, including that or not including that. In this particular kit, do you know, does it include lymphocytes or does it not? And do you generally get like a standardized level of growth hormone or cytokines in this preparation? Do you know?
Yeah, so we basically, in that initial randomized controlled trial, Carol Yan, who was a prior fellow with me here, who helped me run that initial pilot study and then helped me run the randomized controlled trial when she was on faculty at UCSD, she has a lab. And so we actually did look at the specimen, the blood that we were drawing from patients and spinning down, just to ensure that we had the same sort of standardized platelet concentration within the plasma. Now, we didn't go further or deeper looking into the percentage or number of growth factors or anti-inflammatory factors. That's another reason why we think PRP is effective for these people. But she is, you know, having a study ongoing into, you know, the underlying basic science mechanisms of PRP. And so maybe we'll get some of that data soon. But I would say, in general, the kit that I use doesn't have a lot of lymphocytes because I don't want to create another inflammatory reaction. I really just want to be delivering the anti-inflammatory and growth factor properties that the platelets themselves are producing. And so that's why I kind of chose that one.
Well, I'm glad to hear that Carol's investigating that. You know, my interest is always like, so why does it work?
Yeah,
if it, you know, works,
yeah.
What component in the PRP is actually affecting? Are there signs of, you know, new neural growth or whatnot? So that'll be really interesting to see if she can come to any conclusion about that.
For sure.
So kind of wrapping things up. So how do you incorporate this treatment into your current clinical practice? Do you combine it with other treatments? You're still telling patients to do olfactory training. Do they still do topical steroids? How does it practically work in your clinic?
Yeah. So for a study setting, I controlled both the randomized control and the long-term follow-up. I had really wanted patients to have already tried and failed olfactory training, budesonide irrigations, omega-3. And I wanted them to be at least 6 months out from their loss so that we wouldn't have this confounding of spontaneous resolution, at least not a lot. I didn't enroll people beyond a year because I said, you know, if we're going to find something, it's probably going to be within that first year and maybe it'll be good beyond that. But I want to study this very set group of patients. Now that we are not on a study protocol, I really encourage people to do everything they can as soon as they can, because that's one of the sort of factors that we continue to see. You know, the sooner you any intervention takes place for any nerve degenerative issue, you're going to have a greater chance of bringing that back. So now, yes, I do olfactory training, budesonide high volume steroid irrigations, omega-3, and PRP. If patients can afford it, that's the one caveat, that it's self-pay. You know, it's recently studied. It's not FDA approved for this specific purpose. It's approved for orthopedic purposes. And so, you know, based on that, insurance is not going to cover it. And at that point, each institution is just going to have to, you know, work with their own, you know, administrative people to decide like what the patients are going to be charged to cover the cost of nursing time, overhead, the cost of the kits, the centrifuge, et cetera. And so, yes, I've opened it up as a treatment option, not just for post-viral patients, but for all patients with smell loss. And I have an open IRB, a longitudinal observational IRB, so that hopefully we'll be able to pick out, you know, is this helpful for other types of patients? I just published my first case report ever that I've, in my entire medical career, written a case report because I was so shocked that a patient who is a post-traumatic anosmic patient, complete anosmia, 45 years out from his initial loss, had already tried all these other things throughout the years, all the things I listed and all the other crazy things that you hear online, and was still just a 12 out of 40 on the EPSIT. And after three injections, came in with a list of things that he was able to smell with tears streaming down his face, thanking me that I actually agreed to do it. Because at first I told him, no, you shouldn't do this. It just is going to cost you money. It's not going to do anything. But then eventually I relented because he really wanted to say that he had tried every single possible thing. And so, you know, I no longer counsel patients that after a certain set number of years, it's really not possible. I have changed my mind after seeing not just that guy, he's the most extreme example, but other people significantly long out from their loss, much older than I would have thought could have regeneration of nerve. And so, you know, I basically will, you know, try it in whoever wants to try it.
Awesome. Well, that's great. And thank you so much for taking the time, Zara. I think I'm going to have to give that a try down here in Houston and see,
let you know how
that goes.
Please do. And everyone listening, please, you know, watch that video I made. I've shown you the kit. I've shown you the injection site. It's really, you know, not a very complicated procedure. And my smell clinic is booked out over a year and a half. And so I really want other people to start offering this because there's just not enough people to take care of all of these patients.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you again, Zara. I hope to see you at our upcoming ARS CASA meeting in New Orleans. So I can talk to you more in person and catch up.
Yes,
all right.
Thank you
well,
so
thank
much
you
for having
again.
Me.
All right. Thanks. Have a good night. Bye.
Night.